today I'm for this session, for coming session, I'm going to talk about meta search. This is a piece of research related to my PhD study here at UCLA before I graduated and joined Google in 2005. So I structure my talk by first describing what the problem is, and then I pick a few subproblems of meta search, the entire meta search problem, to discuss with you. And then in the end is the summary. So the purpose of this this talk is I'm trying to illustrate how the latest or the basic knowledge in probability theory or statistics has really helped this very new and vibrant research area. Okay, so first, what is the problem called meta search? It's a problem when we're seeing right now on the internet, there are so many document databases. And the content of these databases are typically guarded by a search interface. And because of these search interfaces, a regular search engine is not able to get into, most likely not able to get into the document or the database content behind the search interface. So with that restriction, it's getting harder for a regular internet user to harvest content from these text databases. For example, if a user wants to search applied mathematics, and for those textual databases, SciSeer, this is a computer science bibliography database. PubMed Central is for biomedical literature documents. Amazon, Science Magazine, these are what you're familiar with. For users, they will typically be frustrated by having to interact with so many text databases themselves. And the problem of meta search is trying to solve this frustration of end users by building a meta search engine. Similarly, in the place of today's search engine, which handles the HTML content on the web, on the internet. So with the meta search engine, in a very similar way as search engine, user can just issue the query to the meta search engine. And then what meta search engine do, well, it does is we'll identify a few very relevant sources for the query, maybe a SciSeer or a Science Magazine. They issue the query and then collect the results back from these databases on behalf of the user and then present it back to the user. So in some sense, this greatly simplifies the user's interaction with all of these different, right now, tens of thousands of these or hundreds of thousands of these textual databases. So there are a few sub-problems within the meta search research. The first is database content modeling. The key question is to answer, if we build this meta search engine, how can this engine perceive the content of each database? How does it understand what is really inside each database? The second problem is database selection. So this is necessary when the meta search engine is not able to download or keep a copy of each single database. And this is a very realistic constraint that typically we have to take into consideration when the content is only hosted in those distributed databases. The next question is, after we select those relevant databases or the good databases to issue a bigger query, there's still the issue of translating the user query to the specific query format supported by that database, because all these databases are built on their own. They support some different query formats, even for the same semantics. For example, the join of two terms, A and B, it can be written as A plus B or A and B. Or even some databases supports some additional modifier. You can say, I want a term A in the title and term B in the body, etc. The last problem is called subproblem is result merging. It deals with the problem that after we have issued the query to those a few selected databases, we get the top results returned from each database. We want to present to the user the results in a very unified, very nice way, instead of simply giving a few separate lists. For example, if we have top 10 results retrieved from both science.com and nature.com, how should we present these top two 10 lists? And the worst thing we want is just to simply present the two lists separately. Okay. So because of the time limit, today I'm going to focus on this database content modeling and database selection, these two subproblems. And before I move into the research details, I want to use this slide to give a very simple example of what exactly we're talking about, content modeling and selection. And keep in mind, this is a rather oversimplified version. It's a lot of definition, whatever, in this slide is not really realistic. So by content modeling, in this particular example, the meta search engine keeps a content summary of each database. And specifically, we're talking about two databases, Science Magazine and this PubMed Central. The content summary we keep for each database is a list of words used by this database, plus the number of documents in that database which use this particular word. In some people's work, this is called document frequency, meaning the frequency that this word appears in the database, in this collection of documents. And this is the probability of this word appearing in the document is simply a derivative of these two, this number and the total number of documents in the database by dividing this total number, we have the probability. So this is the content summary. Given what we know about these two databases in this specific format, in these numbers, we're trying to estimate which database has more number of matching documents. So this selection criteria is also very simplified. We're simply selecting the better one based on the number of matching documents. But by having a more number of matching documents doesn't necessarily mean it's a better database. In terms of this selection, we are making a very strong assumption. We're assuming the words appearing in the query are independent, appearing in each document. And that gave us this very simple, oversimplified estimation method. We have the total number, the probability of these two words appearing in each single document. And then we have the estimated number of matching documents, the first one 1,000, the second one being 1. And in the simple case, we know which one is better. Okay, so next I'm going to move on to this the first problem of database content modeling. So depending on the how we solve this problem, and also largely based on the resource constraints the meta search engine has, we can typically categorize all the solutions in these four categories. So at one end of this whole spectrum, we're talking about very relatively idealistic case. It's not that practical. We're talking about all the databases are fully cooperative. They're willing to export their full content to the meta search engine. Plus, a meta search engine should have enough storage to store all the content exported by these textual databases. So by this solution, it means essentially the meta search engine has the exact knowledge or complete knowledge of all the databases. And modeling the content in this case is pretty much trivial. We just do it in a way that we handle a centralized database. So a little bit moving toward the other end, we start to have a little bit more realistic constraints. We start to have non-cooperative databases who are unwilling to export the full content. But we're able, for the meta search engine, it has enough storage space to store a part of each single database. And in this category of solutions, typically we can ask the meta search engine to issue a few queries to each of these databases and download the search results and store it locally. And in this category, what the meta search engine has, it will be a portion of each text database. So even more resource constraint is, what if we have less storage that doesn't allow us to even store part of each database? So in that case, what we want to explore is this concept of content summary. And in the previous slide, I already gave an example of what the content summary looks like. It's definitely more compact and less storage demanding than storing the original documents. But still, in this category, we assume that the databases, although not cooperative enough to export the full content, they are cooperative in terms of exporting some of the content summary based on some standard or protocol. And at the other extreme is we have extremely non-cooperative databases who are not exporting even the content summary. We have to use some approximation methods, trying to get approximate content summary by some kind of sampling method. So basically, because these two categories of solutions is more of a defining the export protocol between a database and the meta search engines, in some sense, trivial in terms of research. So there's been more research focus in these two categories of solutions. And that's what I'm going to talk about in the following few slides. OK, so just to give an example for solutions in this category, we see, for example, Google's product, Google Patents. It's a replica of the entire USPTO patent document base. Because this is public content data, Google is able to host the entire replica of this database. Now, moving toward the other end of that spectrum, if we're able to at least store a portion of each textual database from these non-cooperative databases, which means we have to download the content through some kind of query. And in this specific setup, our goal will be try to download as much as possible from each textual database so that we can have a more comprehensive understanding of that database. And the basic idea is what we call probing. Essentially, just query the database with some short queries, one word or a single word or two word queries. And then we download all the results. But practically speaking, there's always some limits for these non-cooperative databases. For example, if you search use an application interface to talk to Google, you are only allowed to issue 1,000 queries per day. There's that limit. And a lot of these other search interfaces, they enforce similar constraint through the API. So we're always subject to some kind of practical limits. So if we step back a little bit, try to look at this problem of downloading a portion of this the entire database, try to understand the complexity of this problem. It's fairly easy to see. We can somehow map into the classical NP problem called set coverage problem. So if we have the entire database as the entire universe, and each single probe, meaning a single term query, it corresponds to a subset of these documents. Of course, in here, I'm assuming all documents are equal, which can be represented as by a single point. So finding the least number of subsets, which means each subset corresponding to a single probe that covers this entire database, that's the traditional statement of this set coverage problem. But if we just vary this a little bit, we state it the other way. If we want try to find the maximum coverage with a fixed number of subsets, meaning we can only issue a fixed number of probes, but we want to try to get the maximum coverage. If we do the simple conversion, we can see that actually, if we're able to solve this problem, we're able to solve this NP-hard problem. That means this problem is NP-hard as well. Set coverage has been proved to be an NP-complete problem, and also it's shown greedy algorithm is the best possible polynomial algorithm, approximation algorithm, and under that standard, the assumption P doesn't equal to NP. So with this rough understanding about this kind of problem, we know practically probably the best we can do is some kind of greedy solution. But actually, if you think about it, this is slightly harder than the set coverage. Because when we talk about set coverage, we know the cardinality of each subset. But in the case of downloading something from a database, before we issue the query, we don't know the cardinality of that probe. For example, mathematics, before we issue the query of mathematics, we don't know how many documents are really matching this particular probe. So actually, this problem it's even harder than this NP-hard. As we discussed, the greedy probably is so far the most practical way to go to solve this problem. And the greedy solution for the set coverage is it always choose the subset that will give us the maximum cardinality gain, meaning every time we choose a subset, it gives those the subset that give us the most additional elements. But in our case, because when we choose the query to issue to that remote database, we don't know a cardinality corresponding to that specific query, that specific probe. We have to make some assumptions. So there are some strong assumptions or weaker assumptions. A strong assumption is we might assume that the cardinality of subsets remains roughly the same across different databases, so that if we can use some sample database, we observe the cardinality of a bunch of frequent words. We can use those words, the frequent words, picked from the sample database to probe an unknown database. So this is a basic idea. For example, we can build a database with web pages crawled from the internet, and then we just rank the single words according to their frequency. We pick the most frequent words, and then take the next one that gives us the most additional terms, etc. Or we can try this adaptive method. That means we start from some seed probes or seed query terms. Instead of sticking to some pre-determined query or probe sets, we try to find out the query words based on the return result. That means we're picking query words based on the vocabulary of that database. So in some sense, we expect this one to be to issue more focused query words specific to that database.
Is there any problem with these databases won't return any results if you issue a query that has too many responses? I mean, is there a limit? You just get no information back then? Or if you put in into Google, you don't get anything, right?
So. True. definitely, there are, as you said, there are these two cases. If you're issuing a common word, what we call stop words, then you don't expect that. A lot of these cases, you can actually know it before you issue the word. You can keep a stop word list, which is nowadays pretty common across all of these engines. The other question is, if we issue a word that's just too common, for example, we issue a science to a science magazine website, it might just return too many results. A lot of these websites actually besides the total number of queries you can issue per day or per unit time, you also apply a limit at the number of results you can download. So in this research, they talk about the practical constraint that when you can only download, instead of all the results from a query, we can only download, we're only allowed to download the top, say, 100. They have some variation of their algorithm, but I will talk about based on the basic version, which means they assume they can download everything. Okay, so to talk about this adaptive method, meaning we're trying to adaptively select which query to probe based on the existing, the already returned documents. So a few terminology, we use the D of WI to represent the subset returned by probe with using the word WI. And then we assume W1 to WN are these probes already issued. We want to find the next word chosen from these documents already returned, which can maximize the additional documents we didn't see from this probe, but we didn't see in the previous probe. And for this part, if we just rewrite it, we use this term to represent the size of this database. And this is the probability for this term to appear in a single document. We can write this to this different this format. And we can see that for this probability, actually, it can be just measured by observing the existing download documents. We know this number for sure. The only thing, unknown part, is the probability for the next term we've chosen, because we have not issued this to that database.
How rapid is your probability if you're downloading a single web page? You're talking about word frequencies, right? And so if you have a web page with 300 words in it, it seems like your statistics aren't going to be so confident as if you're taking them from pre-existing knowledge of the words. That is, for example, applied mathematics. I know this is a collocation, so from large amounts of text, mm-hmm. I can calculate co-occurrence frequencies and final words and things like that. If I'm not taking a single web page, and that web page has maybe 1,000 words, I'm calculating probabilities based on one web page or even 1,000 web pages. My probabilities aren't going to be as accurate as if I'm taking this over a corpus of millions of documents where I know the frequencies of those words. You're estimating the probabilities, but I don't think necessarily the estimates are that accurate if it's on a small set, page or 10 pages or 50 pages. So one might be better off going from pre-existing knowledge that you have from looking at co-occurrence frequencies mm-hmm. over large amounts of literature, as opposed to, and then you can still adapt. I mean, you can still take, essentially what you're looking for is a word that you believe is in this database is orthogonal to the word that you've already looked at. If applied in mathematics or collocation, it's likely they're going to return a lot of the same documents. You want something that's likely to be in the database, but it's essentially not a collocation or co-occurrence very frequency that whatever you've already previously looked for.
Yeah, I agree. Whatever downloaded so far, especially when you start from the beginning, the statistics will not be that informative. It can be very biased or very skewed. But what we're talking about here, this probability, we're talking about the probability for this specific term to appear in this specific database. So sometimes this probability if we want to be really precise, this probability is a function of both the term itself and this database. So just by observing from a different database, it may not necessarily apply to this one. And this is actually what this adaptive method tried to accomplish, is trying to estimate as close as I can, as it can, of the probability specific to that single database. Okay, so next question is, since the probability of this term appearing in the current database is unknown, what we're trying to do is to have an estimation of this probability instead of obtaining the exact value, because that's impossible. And one idea that the research in that paper had applied is trying to explore this Zipf's law. I guess most likely people here are familiar with this term. So I'm not going to describe this in full detail. Basically, it says if you rank the words in terms of their frequency in a specific corpus or a document, the rank of that word is inversely proportional to the frequency of the word. So if we assume, still in here we're making another assumption, we assume the ranking of these words and some other words appearing in the document we have already seen. The ranking of these words will remain the same from the document we have already downloaded compared to the entire database at large. So I'll illustrate through this animation what I mean by that. So from the existing downloaded documents, which is a sample of the entire database, we have all these different words, and we know the frequency of each word just within our sample. We have, for these frequencies, we have some of these as the exact values, the accurate values, because these are the actual probes represented by the green bar. The red bar means all the other words we have never probed this database. We know their frequency in our sample, but we're trying to estimate the real frequency in the entire database. And using the idea of fitting the Zipf's law, we use all these real values to do curve fitting and figure out the parameters for the Zipf law. And after that, what we do is, since we have the ranking across all these different words, and since we're assuming the ranking doesn't change, if we move from the small sample to the entire database, then we interpolate the actual frequency onto the curve we just fit. And again, this assumption most likely doesn't hold in the very beginning. It's more and more likely to hold as we probe more from the database. Okay, so that's one piece of work of trying to download as much as we can from a textual database with some realistic constraint. And for the next few slides, I'm going to focus on the other category of solution that the meta search engine is trying to understand each database, not by having the exact copy of documents, but rather to keep a content summary. So I've already shown an example of what we mean by a content summary. We have a list of words appearing in the document. And then this is the document frequency. For example, mathematics appear in 2,500 documents. There has been some standard proposals that a text database can follow just to cooperatively export this exact content summary. But unfortunately, so far, it doesn't seem anybody has been really paying attention. The real players hasn't been paying attention to any. We're not serious enough in really implementing such standards. So what we're left with our research is really, without such standard, without the ability to obtain an exact copy of this content summary, is there any way we can approximate this content summary through the basic idea of sampling? So the goal in here, in this sub-problem, is we want to obtain approximate, or this tilde C, which is approximation of the actual content summary. And our goal is to have this approximation to have a high vocabulary coverage and also high accuracy regarding whatever statistic we define in the content summary. And this idea is that it's quite the same as the previous problem of downloading from this database. We're still using the idea of probing, issuing queries to the database, and download a few sample documents. So this is a sample procedure that we pick a single word. In each iteration, we pick a single word, issue the word as a query. We download a few samples from that query, say the top 10 results. And based on some terminating condition, we might go back to the first step, or we might terminate, and then output approximation of the content summary based on the sample we have already downloaded. Now, in this specific study, people actually try to have some empirical verification of whether it's really feasible to really obtain a content summary through this sampling method. First, the question we want to answer is, can we even guarantee that the vocabulary coverage can be good enough? Or if we have the small sample documents, can they really cover the vocabulary of the entire big database? There's an empirical law called Heap's law that actually says it is indeed possible. The Heap's law says the size of a vocabulary, or the size of distinct words that we have already seen or scanned, doesn't increase too much as we scan more number of words because of this coefficient of beta, which is in between 0.4 and 0.6. You plot the curve. When n goes a little larger, the curve flattens out. And this is empirically verified. It's basically verification of the Heap's law.
The sort of end of this, the sort of spirit of n scaling is reminiscent of some sort of diffusive law. Is there some underlying diffusion through word space or something that's governing this? Diffusive processes or random walk processes spread like the square root of the number of steps taken.
I'm not sure. I haven't taken a really look. Close look at this the Heap's law study. Yeah. Yes.
This kind of changes very much when your corpus is words from a newspaper article compared, if that's your corpus versus Amazon.com, which would be very specific, versus science magazines, because each of them have different domains where they're going to specialize.
With different collection of documents, these parameters will be different.
And if you're interested in words that are very rarely used, chasing the tail, this may be as useful as finding out those words that are frequently used in your corpus.
True.
Thank you.
True. And the other question is, from the small sample of documents we downloaded, is there any way we can estimate the statistic we are interested or concerned about? For example, the document frequency that I use as an example. The question, is it really possible that we estimate this, the document frequency of this word in the entire database just by looking at the sample we have already downloaded? Now, if we look closely to all these words that we have encountered through the sample, there are just a few words that we use as the actual probe. For those words, we have the actual statistic for sure. But there are the other words, W prime, which just appears in the sample docs, but we have never issued them to the database. For those ones, we need to estimate the corresponding statistics. And again, the idea here is very similar to the previous Zipf law interpolation idea. We plot out a Zipf's curve, a ranking of all these words based on the sample. And then, because we also have some real values, we do some curve fitting and then interpolate the unknown values onto that fitted curve. Okay. So, this paper talked a little bit more detail about this method, and I'm not going to spend too much on the detail. So, there's one last question we want to visit before we move on to the next problem of data section. So this problem still belongs to the content modeling. It asks, does the content of database really remain the same, remain constant, or it rather evolves from time to time? And in this study, people did an empirical verification to see that actually the content summary, or the actual content of database, of these real databases, it does evolve fairly fast. So in this study, people have about 150 web databases. They take a snapshot of each single database every week. And this whole process lasts for a year. They use a simple statistic, document frequency. And then how they measure the difference between the latest snapshot and another snapshot t time ago, which t is a number of weeks. They use this KL divergence as the change measure. And this is showing the y-axis, and the x-axis is show the t measure. If you look at the t, as t goes up, the change is fairly or noticeable from the beginning, which means there's no change to the end, about 50 weeks. Now, from the empirical observation, because we do observe changes, the question is, can we somehow model this change using some empirical law or whatever, so that we might be able to determine that at a certain point, we can predict the amount of changes beyond the tolerance level so that we want to resample the document again to keep our content summary up to date. So in this study, people proposed to use this KL divergence measure between the current and the content summary back in time t. And they're trying to apply the principle called survival analysis, which is a commonly seen method. And in here, we introduce the random variable t, big T, which is a time that the KL divergence exceeds a pre-specified threshold. That means the change is simply too much, and we probably need to refresh our content summary to keep it up to date. Now, just by applying the basics of survival analysis, we have the survival function and also the hazard function. And our goal is, how can we predict the hazard function and afterwards the survival function? So in the study, those researchers proposed to use the Cox proportional hazard regression model. Basically, the model says the logarithm of the hazard function is a linear of some base function plus a linear representation of the logarithm of some base hazard function plus some other predictor variables. And there's some predictors we might be able to think of regarding each database. Definitely, the pre-specified threshold will be a predictor. The higher the threshold value essentially affects when we consider a content summary has changed or has not, whether it has survived. But in the study, people have also observed that just looking at the domain of that particular database, whether it's downloaded, hosted on .com, .edu, or .gov, it's very interesting to observe that these different databases exhibit totally different hazard function behavior. And also, people study this the size, logarithm of the size of the database. And also, because we collect some training data, we use about, in the study, people used about 10 weeks as training. We can observe how likely the database changed over the course of 1 week, using that as a measure to predict how likely a database is going to change in the long run. So after we train the Cox model, what this study finds out actually, the specific domain variable, it doesn't really satisfy the Cox proportional assumption. And in the end, instead of using the simple Cox model, those people have to use the stratified Cox model, meaning they have to have a separate base function for each domain. And actually, in this graph, I show the base function learned from each domain is actually rather different. We have databases from different domains exhibiting quite different survival function according to as time changes. Okay. There's some further training result about learning the beta coefficient, which I want to skip because of time. So after the training, people have this the survival function, which is learned from some training data. What we want to do is, we have this survival function, which is the likelihood that this database has not changed so much. And given that, because this is already learned, we can compute or predict the survival sometime down the road. What we want to use this survival function is to design some update policy so that meta-searcher can periodically resample a lot of these different databases to try to keep its content summary up to date. So I'm not going to talk about detail. The update policy essentially is a solution to some optimization problem, trying to optimize a objective function. And what we are trying to solve is this policy that for each database, we want to know its separate update frequency. Meaning, for example, whether we should sample this database 2 times per week or 0.5 times per week, meaning every once in 2 weeks. And these policies, they are subject to some practical constraints. For example, our bandwidth usage for the meta search engine. Or there might be constraints imposed on the other side of the textual database. They don't allow us to query too fast. So the constraint, theoretically, we can write it out as the sum of these frequencies equal to a global cap or something. So with this, all these formalization, we can, it's a problem that we can solve by the Lagrange multiply method. And there's some simple results discussed in that paper, which I'm also going to skip. Okay.
Rather than the notion that I need to predict when I need to update things, wouldn't it make more sense to just have an adaptive, continuously querying process? Because imagine what's happening in these databases, like in some biomedical databases. All of a sudden, stem cells become the thing, right? There's a huge increase in the number of papers about stem cells.
Yes.
If you merely detected the fact that stem cells is the thing, there's relatively few queries you could capture that expands. And so you might just want to try and predict what the emerging trends are that are leading to the changes in the database.
Also, you have different kinds
yes.
of work. One is adding more documents, and the other is the documents themselves change, you know, a Wikipedia article or whatever. And so
yes.
it seems also in your model, again, it's the adaptive change. You can see how is the database changing and whether it's important. For example, in the Amazon database, there may be certain core summary which don't change, like the ISBN, and there may all be all these reviews that you may or may not care about.
Yes.
So you might have some waiting on. So I agree, sort of adapting how it changes, whether it's growing, the individual wants to change it, whether those changes are important to you.
Yes. I think maybe one solution is to take on more predictive variables into the equation. Yeah, but there might be other solutions as well. Okay, so with that, I move on to the second sub-problem I want to address.
So the underlying assumption is that the more different the words are, the more diverse the database is. Is that
the question is, the more...
So the more diverse the words
uh-huh.
are in the database, the more diverse the database is. So, and that's kind of the main
yes,
thing driving the model, right?
If you actually look at the training result, that's, I think it's a very interesting note you make. If we look at the coefficient for the size, it actually says the larger the database size is, it's not exactly the diversity of the vocabulary, but it might have something. Here is just the sheer size, meaning the number of documents in the database. It has a positive effect on the change scale. So the larger the database is, it's more likely to change.
And I was curious, Because you also had the different distributions for the different types of databases in .gov and .com.
Yes.
And do you think in any way that might be actually related to the type of words being sampled? I mean, is it possible to product of that?
You mean the sampling method might also be a variable. I think it's an interesting point. In the previous study, people actually show that the sample that you actually obtain is quite resilient to the sample method you actually apply. It might be worth trying, but my guess is probably the sampling method doesn't affect too much.
That's good. Yes, you showed this picture. So this domain name, MISC, I'm not too familiar with this, but this is very different from the other ones. What kind of...
MISC is... I think they just put whatever doesn't fall into underneath.com.
MISC is not real domain name, but everything else.
I should have mentioned that.
Oh, I see.
It can be .tv, .net, whatever.
Oh, okay.
All these other small... Because the category is too small, they just got locked altogether.
Uh-huh. Isn't that also put over .jp, .pt, .br, all the country names as well?
I think the country names are stripped off. I'm not quite sure. I need to check again for that. Yeah. Okay. So move on to the next subproblem called database selection. It's a natural extension after we have modeled the content of each database, meaning the meta search engine knows roughly what is in each database. So after that, when we have a user issued query, we want to direct this query to the most relevant databases. This selection is not always necessary, but it is necessary when the meta search engine doesn't have the entire replica of each single database, meaning it cannot answer the query just based on its own local copies. It has to ask the other database to return results. And also, it has to bring another significant benefit. It means for each single benefit, we're not flooding the entire network, flooding all these databases with that single query, asking everyone to answer that query. We're only selectively picking a few that we think that are the best to answer this one. So it really reduces the processing load if you consider everyone to be within the entire system. If we formalize this whole problem a little bit, we have a query. We're talking about free text query, consisting of a list of words, W1 to WM. And we have N databases. So instead of purely saying select databases, it's in the exact sense we are trying to rank the database. Depending on how much resource we want to use, we can pick the top ranked databases and go down the list to ask these databases. And the ranking, in a formal representation, we're trying to have a relevancy score defined for each database regarding this particular query. And that we represent by this function of R, DB, and Q. So this relevancy score, conceptually, it can be all different kind of variants. It can be as simple as number of matching documents in the particular database. Of course, it's a very low quality relevance score because a database with this with a high score in this sense doesn't necessarily mean it's a good database. It can also be with a little more sophistication, it can be the similarity between the query and the top documents returned by that particular database. And similarity, typically we're talking about the common vector space dot product similarity between the query and the document. So there are some different variation you can play around with this formulation. It can be the sum or the average of the similarities if we just strictly pick the top k documents from each database. Or we can apply a single threshold. We set a cutoff point for the results from each database. And then we do a sum or average of these similarity, query document similarities. Or we can even be as fancy as measuring the relevancy as how it's judged by the users. It can be explicit relevance feedback solicited from the user by asking the user to explicitly say what are the helpful results, helpful documents. Or it can be a non-intrusive method that people use a lot in nowadays the web research, which is the click behavior, which result people, the user clicks on, and the sequence they click on these results. But regardless of how we define the relevancy score, if we try to make it a little bit more general or abstract, we can just represent it as a function, as a relevancy. And typically, this relevancy score is unavailable. It's unavailable because the meta search engine doesn't have the exact copy of each single one. The best it can do is to estimate this relevancy score based on the content summary. And in a lot of cases, even the content summary is an approximation. Okay, so in the next few slides, I will be walking through some very simple example of how we estimate this relevancy score in the previous studies. This is one we have already illustrated in the very beginning, using a term or word independence assumption, meaning all these query terms appear independently in the database. With that assumption, we can apply essentially we can compute this relevancy as the size of the database times the probability of all these terms appearing together in a single document. Okay. So another different formulation of this relevancy method, instead of saying it's the simple one of number of matching documents, we try a little bit sophisticated measurement of relevancy. We measure the relevancy of database as those documents in the database returned by the database with a similarity higher than the pre-specified threshold L. And we sum up all these similarity values. And here the similarity is defined by the vector dot product. Now, in order to estimate this relevancy definition, the authors of that particular paper, they claim that they will need these two pieces of information for the content summary. We have seen the document frequency, but they propose that there's another measure we will need in order to make that estimation for the previous relevancy definition. So if we try to interpret what this measure is, it means for a particular word, the sum of all its weights in all the documents in this particular database. And in IR, information retrieval research, this entire vector for all the weights for different words, if we represent them across the entire vocabulary, is actually the vector what we call the centroid of the entire database considered as a cluster of document vectors. So it's a rather familiar concept. And then we have a few discussions when if we set the threshold to be zero, what the estimation for this relevancy method is, and what if the threshold goes beyond zero. I'm going to skip the next few slides. Basically, what I'm trying to say here is, in order to make the estimation of this relevancy method, people still need to make certain assumptions. Sometimes the assumptions is a little bit strong or unrealistic. And the last thing I want to mention, just briefly touch upon, is another piece of work in which the authors proposed this probabilistic model for the errors we make in the estimation. Because in the previous slides, we have been talking about estimating the relevancy instead of obtaining the exact relevancy. And in terms of estimation, there's always a chance that we'll make error. And this is a definition, we can plot out this a simple relative definition of an error, which is the difference between the actual value and the estimated value over the estimation. And there's this interesting study that shows, just by looking at a sample database, what does the experiment tell us is the actual error behavior actually resemble or replicate itself if we have a reasonable sample size. So a little bit of detail about this experiment. We have two query sets, which are totally disjoint. And we formulate these to be focused on the specific topic of this database. The size of each query set is about 1,000. And for each query set, we use the query in that query set and then compute the amount of error we make by the estimation, whatever the estimation method we choose. And then after that, we plot out the error distribution from these two query sets. And they look interestingly similar. In fact, in the same paper, we have a much more rigorous study about how these distribution might they look similar. We studied a couple of documents and used the statistical test. It really shows on a single database, as we throw in a little bit queries, this error behavior starts, the behavior of this error distribution starts to saturate after we have sampled a few hundred queries. Now that gives us an opportunity that rather, instead of trying to make our estimation as accurate as possible, in some sense, making estimation is like a one-shot deal. We're trying to make estimate the value, and then that's it. But in this probabilistic model, we're trying to, instead of saying the estimation is a single value, we try to observe the error of the behavior of the errors based on a previous sample, and then use that error behavior. We want to apply it to the new query. Okay. I want to quickly go through this slide and then skip the next if you want. So again, the idea here is after we can, if we can observe this error distribution by sampling a few queries, what this error distribution can help us for a new query, which we have never seen before, is, so this is by definition, we have this, the real relevancy to be, is represented by this one. And then from the previous samples, we observe the behavior of the error to follow maybe some kind of distribution. So we have the error distribution for this specific database. And then the other input we have is, using whatever estimation we have, we can compute an estimation for the R tilde. Combining all these three facts, what we have is, for example, if we're estimating 1,000 to be the relevancy, and we have a chance of making 50% over or 50% lower, then the actual relevancy for this new query we have never seen before is likely to follow this distribution. So we have just turned this error distribution we observed and applied to this new query and just formulated this relevancy distribution for something we have never seen. And this is just the starting point for this probabilistic model. To choose database instead of based on single value, but rather by looking at distribution. So there are a lot of animations going on, which I want to skip. And there are some empirical study that shows by looking at the scores using a distribution as really give us a lot of benefit compared to just looking at the estimation at a single point.
Are there any studies of the like comparing different types of relevancy, like the, some of the similarity-based ones versus the user-judged ones? Is it, do they generally correlate with each other in some way, or?
Very good question. In the traditional information research, information retrieval research, I think people have done that on a single database, single centralized database. Because people always try to, similarity is something the program computes. And when people study different similarity method, they always try to correlate that, the new similarity method, against the training data or the, what people call the gold standard, the user has already marked in the data set. So it is studied in that context. I don't see any specific study in the distributed context like what we have discussed.
Right, because I mean, users doing the same query would have a distribution of relevancy scores as well. And I wonder if your distribution would somehow map to that distribution.
True, that's true. If we just observe from the user side, there's always a probability that the user will like or dislike some results we present to him. So if we look at, so one perspective to look at that is trying to correlate the distribution of the, just the similarity, some mechanical numbers we can compute with the distribution we compute from the user. Another perspective is we can, in fact, directly just predict the distribution of that user response. Okay, so these are the some of the details in the paper I'm now going to go into detail here. One last thing, so after this piece of study, we tried to generalize the problem a little bit. Originally, it was a very specific database problem. And we find it quite interesting because it seems applicable to some other application as well. It's what we call a lazy kid problem. As you have read through the slide, it has the flavor as what we, I have just described to you. We generalize and humanize this problem. So the TA wants to find out just the top K score in a student's after the exam, but without the hassle of actually grading all the exam sheets. So for this problem, we have an input. We know it's very reasonable. Actually, you can generalize whatever you like into other application. It's rather an applicable assumption. And for each student, by observing their past behavior and performance, we have a distribution for that particular student. Very specific. Each student might have. Some student is very narrowly focused, very consistent performing. Some other student might be vibrating. And then the output is we want a scoring strategy. Because we want to score as less as possible because we're lazy. So we want to maximize the correctness. Because every time, even without scoring, we might be guessing. We know before I score, if I'm a TA, I know maybe there are a few people in the class who are performing quite well in the past. I'm guessing these are the top three students in this final exam. But that knowledge or that belief will have much higher confidence as I score more exam sheets. So the problem here is how can we maximize the correctness? Yeah, every time I'm guessing, I'm adjusting my guess. How can I maximize the correctness of my guess as I score students? And actually, there, in this later study, we have provided some very limited insights into this problem. We proved only under some very special cases, a greedy scoring strategy is optimal. There are a lot more interesting factors we haven't explored. For example, in general cases, respect to these, what I mean by the special cases. And also, when we score our exam sheet, typically the scoring cost is uniform across all the different sheets. In real world, the cost of probing one or scoring one student might be not uniform. And also, the distribution may not be time invariant. They can legitimately change as time pass by. How can we handle those cases? So that's been a very interesting problem. Okay, so with that, I want to summarize the discussion today. I present this meta search as a still, it's a challenging problem. A lot of, it's a very active research area. A lot of people are still contributing to all these different sub-problems. And today we look at these two sub-problems, database content modeling and the selection. In the modeling sub-problem, we have basically we've seen solutions use sampling. And the sampling is typically, it's not just blind sampling. We're typically using some traditional wisdom, for example, the Zipf law or the Heap's law. And also, there has been a study to model, try to model the change of content over time using survival analysis. And for the subproblem database selection, there's these all kinds of estimation method proposed trying to estimate the database relevancy based on the limited knowledge we know. And also there's this work of modeling the estimation using a probabilistic distribution rather than a single point value. And in the end, we see this the problem of how can we find optimize this probing strategy for a collection of distribution given us as input. And I list a few references in the end. And if you're interested, you can take a look. Any questions?
In metasearch, it also seems a big issue. You have talked earlier about in a perfect world where everybody allowed everybody to have complete access to their databases, this would be a simple problem, but it seems a little bit more difficult than that to me because it's also the issue of saying which things are the same. You know, in two booksellers, you can do it by ISBN, but for more complicated databases, sort of removing the duplicates, they're never going to be exactly the same. There's going to be some, somebody's going to model a car this way, and somebody else is going to model the car that way.
Sure.
But it also seems to be the issue of sort of combining and finding equivalence.
Exactly. People sometimes classify that problem under a slightly different umbrella. In the database community, people call that as data integration. Integration meaning for each source you want to integrate, pretty much you have the full content of the data. But it's rather duplication, inconsistency in the terminology, in the units you use. Because this can be, the data you integrate can be perfectly just textual databases, or it can be structural databases. It can be meters, inches, feet, all these different data. And how you design a system that really merge all the data together. That's another known challenging problem that they're just so far not a good enough solution yet.
Any more questions?